Tonight's Monday night, June 4th at Sherit Israel, our last class, Parshat Palotcha. We're going to begin with an overview of how we got to where we are. How did we get to the 8th to 12th chapters of the book of Numbers? That's this week's Torah portion, Bahalotcha, chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. It deals with the preparations for the Israelite journey from Mount Sinai to the land of Israel, and actually with the beginning of the journey. So I want to make sure that chronologically and geographically we have our coordinates straight so we know how we got where we are, and there we'll know perhaps at least how we're going to where we're going. So we remember that the Israelites, the former slaves, left Egypt on the beginning, which is the night of the 15th day of what was to become the first month of the year. We call it Nisan, and it's in the spring, of course. And that was after about 210 years of slavery, and then after the 10 plagues, the 10th plague, which was the 14th of the month, going into the 15th of the month, the afternoon and the evening, the night, what became the first month of the year, Nisan, the 10th plague. They're eating their Passover meal, and then the Egyptians throw them out. Be gone, we don't want all of our children to die, they were told, and they begin their journey. They go through the desert towards the Reed Sea, of course. After 7 days, they cross on dry land, and then they're on their way in the desert to Mount Sinai. The journey to Mount Sinai takes approximately 50 days from the 15th of Nisan until they get to the beginning of the month of Sivan. 50 days, 7 times 7 weeks. At Mount Sinai, they get there about the 1st of the month, and then the 6th of the month, the 7th of the month, there's actually a machloket, there's an argument, the Torah is given, the Ten Commandments, that means. So remember what happens immediately after the Ten Commandments are given. Moses goes up to the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. He gets the Luchot Abrit, the tablets. And as he's about to come down, after 40 days and 40 nights, with the tablets in his hand, two tablets of stone, he hears a commotion at the bottom of the mountain. God also gives him a signal that something is happening down there that's not kosher. And he meets up with the golden calf when he gets there. He breaks the tablets, remember? And he chastises and punishes the Israelites, and he goes up the mountain again for 40 days and 40 nights to ask for forgiveness from God. He stays up there, according to tradition, and the Torah's not clear, he stays up there for 80 days and nights. 40 plus 40, and if you add the 40 before the golden calf, that comes to 120. If you think about it, he went up there on what we celebrate as Shavuot, meaning a week ago. He comes down 120 days later with forgiveness for the Jewish people after praying and beseeching God to forgive them for the golden calf. He comes down with forgiveness. He comes down also with the Luchot Tashniot, with the second tablets. 120 days from Shavuot is Yom Kippur. He comes down on Yom Kippur. So the day that he brings forgiveness from God to the Jewish people for the golden calf is the day that became the day of forgiveness, the day of atonement. So Moses comes down, it's the day of atonement, he gives them the second tablets, they're forgiven, and life begins again. What does that mean? That he gives them the commandments that he's been told while he was up on high. The major commandment, at least the way the Torah tells the story, is the building of the tabernacle, the commandment to construct the tabernacle. So that begins the day after Yom Kippur and goes on for the whole winter. They're still at Mount Sinai, and for the whole winter, what we would call October, November, December, January, February, and even March, they are building the tabernacle, and the tabernacle is completed approximately the first day of the first month, which means exactly 11 and a half months after leaving Egypt. Right, they left in Nisan, what we call Nisan, it's the first month, on the 15th of the month. The tabernacle is completed the first day of the first month of the second year. So it's been 11 and a half months. The minute the tabernacle is completed, well, they're about ready now to begin their journey with the tabernacle and with the Luchot HaShniot, with the second tablets in the ark, in the tabernacle. They're about to begin their journey to the land of Israel. That's what has transpired from the Exodus until now, until our Torah portion. So all the while, since the getting of the Torah, in the middle of the book of Exodus till now, all the second half of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and all of the book of Numbers until now, until chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, they are at one place, haven't moved. Mount Sinai, still there. Okay. Now, let's just think how it happens that they haven't traversed any geography, and we've gone through almost two books of the Torah, and they're still in the same place. The second half of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and the book of Numbers until where we are now in chapters 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. So the second half of Exodus has no geography, no movement. They're just there at Mount Sinai building the tabernacle. That's all it is. Moses comes down from the mountain, gives the command, and they start building. And if anyone remembers, there's lots of boring Torah portions about building the tabernacle. The end of the book of Exodus says it's finished. If it's finished at the book of beginning of Exodus, why are they still there in the same place at Mount Sinai in the 10th and 11th and 12th chapters of Numbers? Because Leviticus has no time, no chronology. Nothing happens in Leviticus. It's a book of laws, but it's not a book of stories. Time doesn't pass. I'm just going to get my phone, perhaps someone at the door telling us to... Hello? Yes? So are you going to be at Sherith Israel at 7:30? Great. Thank you very much. Just wanted to make sure. Thank you. That was the cantor. Just wanted to make... He's going to be here at 7:30. He's using the building also, so we don't have to feel bad.
Oh, okay. I know. That's why
I feel bad. We pay members.
Okay, well, I don't have to feel bad.
But I feel bad.
Okay, sorry for that interruption. So the book of Vayikra, Leviticus, is lots and lots of laws about the tabernacle, about the sanctuary, but there's almost no history there. There's no stories. Just about the only story there is a second telling of the consecration of the tabernacle. It's described at the end of the book of Exodus, when they completed it. And then Leviticus is just a list of laws that have to do with the tabernacle. And in the middle of the book of Leviticus is another take, another perspective on the event already described at the end of Shemot, Exodus, the finishing, the completion, and then the consecration of the tabernacle. So we begin Bamidbar, we begin Numbers, they're still in the same place. And as far as we're concerned, they've completed the building of the tabernacle, because the completion described at the end of Exodus, described in the middle of the book of Leviticus, and in last week's Torah portion, about chapter 6 and 7 of Bamidbar, there's a third description of the consecration of the tabernacle. One perspective at the end of Exodus, one perspective the middle of Leviticus, and a third perspective on it in the beginning of the book of Numbers. So finally, that's behind us, and we get to chapter 8, this week's Torah portion, and we're reading about the final preparations for packing up the camp, and starting to move towards the land of Israel. And the next chapter, they actually begin moving, chapter 10, in this week's Torah portion, which means that had everything gone right, well, another few days, they'd be in the land of Israel. But something went wrong. Which is what? Why didn't...
Did Moses use his rod to create...
Okay, one thing that goes wrong is he's punished for striking the rock or something. It's not clear what. But before that, what goes wrong is the sin of the spies.
Yeah.
Right? The Israelites would have walked from now, from where we are in this Torah portion, into the land of Israel in 3 or 4 days. But on the way, they send out the spies. There's a terrible sin, and they are punished by having to spend 40 years, actually 39, waiting in the desert until it's time to enter. But that will do next year. Okay. If you're following the sheets, I just finished the first sheet, and we're looking at the back of it. We're about to begin this week's Torah portion. After that, historical and literary introduction. Chapter 10. of the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, Parshat Behalotcha, chapter 10, verses 29 to 36. Ready? Ready. Moses said to Chovav, in the English only, it's on page 224 of the JPS. Do you want Moshe said to Chovav, son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. By the way, he's called other names.
Yeah, isn't that Jethro?
Yeah, that's Jethro, Yitro. He's also called Reuel. Here, Reuel is his father, so there's a big controversy over names, but we don't concern ourselves tonight with that. So Moses said to Chovav, son of Reuel the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, we are setting out for the place of which the Lord has said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will be generous with you. For the Lord has promised to be generous to Israel. I will not go, he replied to them, but will return to my native land. He said, please do not leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness and can be our guide. So if you come with us, we will extend to you the same bounty that the Lord grants us. That's what it says. So we're not told here how Chovav got to Mount Sinai, how he joined the Israelites in camp there, but all we see is that he's there, and now that they're on their way to pack up and go to the land of Israel, Moses invites him to come, and he says, no, I'm not coming. Moses says, please, and we don't know what happened in the end. It doesn't say, did he change his mind and stay, or did he actually go back to his country, and we'll get to that in another moment. Before we go forward, I just want to tell a short Devar Torah that I heard about 30 years ago from my teacher in Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Dov Bigon. He asked the following question. This is really beautiful, I think. And perhaps some of you have read, I wrote about this in the past. Moses asks his father-in-law to stay with them and to travel with them through the desert on the way to the land. And the reason is because he's a man of the desert. He's lived there his whole life. And Moses says to him, please be our guide. Right? That's what it said in verse 31. Don't leave us, inasmuch as you know where we should camp in the wilderness and can be our guide. So the question could be asked, why did the Israelites need a guide? We know from the book of Exodus that they're being guided, and also in the book of Numbers it goes over this, they're being guided by the cloud in the daytime, the cloud of God, the fire at night. God is bringing them the manna from heaven and water. What more do they need? Why do they need a human guide when they have God? So Rav Dov Bigon gave the following answer. He said that they have such a good guide, God, that he will protect them and bring them in the proper places, and they'll never know what pitfalls and what obstacles and what dangers they avoided because God brought them in the proper way. They won't know where there's sandstorms because they'll avoid them. They won't know where there's scorpions because they'll avoid them. They won't know where there's quicksand because they'll avoid them. They won't know where there's windstorms because they'll avoid it all with God at the helm. What they need, perhaps, is someone to tell them, God is guiding you in this direction. It must be because over there I know there's quicksand. And over there I know there's a northern wind that would prevent you from moving forward. And there I know that there's something else. They need someone to point out to them all the bounty and all the grace that God is providing them with. And, of course, it applies in life in general. If you don't know what your blessings are, you can't appreciate them. You need someone to point out to you what could have happened. You have to remember that there are so many people in the hospital and so many people who are in dire straits. You have to remember all the things that can happen. And sometimes you need someone to point out, or perhaps I should say we need ourselves to point out what could have been and wasn't. There are so many blessings, so many things to be grateful for. So according to Rav Dov Bigon, that was to be the task of Moses' father-in-law. Closing parentheses, we can go back to the story. Okay, so after chapter 10, and we don't know if Reuel stays with them or not, comes chapter 11. We're going to skip chapter 11, and then we'll go to chapter 12. Chapter 12, we're going to read all 13 verses of it. We'll just skip the last two or three at the end. This is the end of this week's Torah portion, chapter 12. When they were in Chatzirot, in other words, they began their journey from Mount Sinai, Miriam and Aharon spoke against Moshe because of the Cushite woman he had married. They complained against their leader. He married a Cushite woman. They said, "Has the Lord spoken only through Moshe? Has he not spoken through us as well? Why does he get such privileges?" The Lord heard it. Now Moshe was a very humble man, more so than any other man on earth. Suddenly the Lord called to Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tent of meeting." So the three of them went out. The Lord came down in a pillar of cloud, stopped at the entrance of the tent, and called out, "Aaron and Miriam." The two of them came forward, and he said, "Hear these my words. When a prophet of the Lord arises among you, I make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moshe. He is trusted throughout my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, plainly and not in riddles, and he beholds the likeness of the Lord. How then did you not shrink from speaking against my servant Moshe?" Still incensed with them, the Lord departed. As the cloud withdrew from the tent, there was Miriam stricken with snow-white scales. When Aaron turned towards Miriam, he saw that she was stricken with scales. And Aaron said to Moshe, "O my Lord, account not to us the sin which we committed in our folly. Let her not be as one dead who emerges from his mother's womb with half his flesh eaten away." So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "O God, pray, heal her." There's so much here. We're going to focus only on the first two, even the first one verse. And the rest of it we'll leave for some other time. The rest of it is that God got very upset at Miriam and Aaron for speaking against Moshe. But what we're going to focus on is actually what did they say, what bothered them, what was going on, what was their claim? Why were they upset with Moshe? So that brings us to the question, who is this woman he married? And is it the two possibilities? It's the wife we know about from the book of Exodus, Tzipora, or it's not. Those are the two possibilities. So, I'm going to go in the direction that most, almost all the commentators go in, is that it's Tzipora, the same woman. Okay, so he's married to Tzipora, so what are they getting so upset about? Now, believe it or not, there is a approach in the Midrashic literature that is found in so many different places. It seems to be the accepted approach, and this approach says that what Miriam and Aaron were so upset by, is the fact that Moses divorced his wife. And you say, where does it say that? Well, it doesn't. It doesn't say that. It says here, he married a Cushite woman. The Midrash says the Cushite woman is Tzipora, but the issue is not he married her. The issue is he married her and he divorced her. Where does it say that? It doesn't say that. How did the Midrash get that? I'm not really certain how the Midrash got to that, but I am certain of one other thing. The Midrash couldn't accept the simple, straightforward meaning of the verses that Miriam and Aaron are upset with Moshe for marrying his wife. And the reason the Mefarshim, the commentators, the Midrash, could not accept that that's what it means, that's what it says. They couldn't accept that for the simple reason that Moses got married 60 years ago. And why are Miriam and Aaron complaining now? Of course, we'll have to also ask, what are they complaining about? But first off, it looks like the Midrash says, what do you mean? How could they be complaining about his wife That was 60 years ago. So what I'd like to do is try and answer that question. Why would it be, that's what we're going to deal with next half an hour, why would it be that Miriam and Aaron are upset, extremely upset, with Moshe for marrying a woman he married 60 years ago? What happened right now that got them so upset? That's going to be the question. By the way, I forgot to say something. I forgot to explain why Tzipor is called a Cushite woman. And the answer is simple. Because Cush and Midian is the country she's from, are sometimes referred to as the same place. And I just brought for you verses here from the book of Habakkuk, which happens to be last week's Haftarah. You can just look at verse 7 there from the book of Habakkuk. I see the tents of Cushan in affliction, the curtains of the land of Midian do tremble. And that's poetic. I don't know how you say in English, when the poet repeats himself, he refers to this a certain place, both as Cushan and as Midian. It's the same thing. Cush is Cushan. Today we call it Ethiopia. Midian is in the same place. So Tzipora, the wife of Moshe that we know about from the beginning of the book of Exodus, and we'll go back to that today, she is from the land of Cush, the land of Ethiopia, land of Midian, it's the same thing. And for some strange reason, 60 years after their marriage, Aaron and Miriam are complaining bitterly against Moshe for marrying a Cushite woman. By the way, just add one more thing. Cush, Ethiopia, the word Cush in Hebrew means black. It's the land of the black people.
Is there any school that says maybe this woman was new, or that she was a second wife? Or
yes, there is. There is.
So is there a whole commentary on that as well? That
there is as well.
Okay.
There is as well. Yeah.
But you're not accepting that.
I'm not going that direction tonight. Okay. There's no evidence in the Torah of any second wife except for this one verse. And there's nothing. But there is one commentator, Ibn Kaspi, his name is, in Spain in the 13th century, that says this must be a second wife. But there's no foundation for that. All the other commentators say it's Tzipora. Like I said, most say that it's Moses divorcing Tzipora, but I'm going to try and suggest that it means what it says in the text here. We'll have to explain why after 60 years is there reason to get upset with him marrying Tzipora. So here we go. Ready, right? So following the sheets that I prepared here, we are going back. This is D. And the last third of the second side of the sheet. We're going back to the book of Exodus to witness Moses' marriage and the events that lead up to that marriage.
Shmot chapter
2. Shmot chapter 2. Back in time. Exodus 2, verse 15. This material we've seen in the past, we all know it. It's just a little bit of background. Chapter 2 of the book of Exodus, verse 15. When Paro learned of the matter, he sought to kill Moshe, but Moses fled from Paro. This is after Moshe, as a young man, kills the Egyptian taskmaster. Mistakenly, he becomes a marked man. He's a fugitive. And then it says he arrived in the land of Midian and sat down beside the well. Now, the priest of Midian had seven daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But shepherds came and drove them off. Moses rose to their defense and he watered their flock. When they returned to their father, Reuel, here he's called Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds," that's Moshe. "He even drew water for us and watered their flock." And Jim is drawing water to water the flock. He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? Why did you leave the man? Ask him in to break bread." Moses consented to stay with the man, and he gave Moshe his daughter Tzipora as wife. There she is. They're getting married. She bore a son whom he named Gershom, for he said, "I've been a stranger in a foreign land." Okay, so he gets married as a young man, Tzipora and Moshe. They're living by his father-in-law, and Moses becomes a shepherd, working with his father-in-law and all his sisters-in-law. And then, of course, one day he's in the desert. with the flocks, and he has a vision of God, the burning bush. And in that vision, as you know, God suggests to him, in rather strong language, I want you to go back to Egypt and take upon yourself the mantle of leadership to extricate the Israelites from slavery. And Moses eventually does that.
Reuel was a priest of the Midianites?
That's what it says.
So what religion was he practicing? Or if Moses lived among them, he would have been with a guy practicing
that
religion.
We can assume that Moses had something to do with polytheism. Idolatry. Whatever you want to call it. Okay. There's even a midrash, by the way, parenthetical, that says that Moses and his father-in-law made a deal. And the deal was that the first son that Moses and Zipporah have will become an idolatrous priest, and the second son Moses can train in monotheism. They'll make 50-50. We know such things today. That's what the midrash says. But that's a whole different can of kosher worms. So then, we're going to go to chapter 4 at the end of the burning bush incident. Chapter 4, verse 18. This is what Moses does after the vision of God at the burning bush. Chapter 4, verse 18. Moses went back to his father-in-law, Yeter. Here he has another name. And said to him, let me go back to my kinsmen in Egypt and see how they are faring. And Yitro said to Moses, go in peace. So it looks like Moses is accepting the mantle of leadership put upon him by God at the burning bush. And he's about to go to Egypt and do what he has to do. We're going to go now to chapter 4, verse 24. We're just skipping a few verses. So I remind everyone that Moses is now on his way back to Egypt. And we remember that he spends there a while. He talks to Paro, talks to the Israelites, does some signs, and then there's 10 plagues, and the Israelites leave Egypt. Let's say that Moses was there for a year, approximately. Now, since when the Israelites left Egypt, Moses was 80, the Torah tells us, so now he must be about 79. It's about a year before they leave. He must be at 79. So a long time has passed. He got married when he was probably 17, 20, 23. Who knows? He was a young man. 60 years have passed approximately. Long time. He's been married a while. And now he takes his wife and his children with him on the way to Egypt to do this great mission that God has asked him to do. And then we come to these unbelievably difficult verses that we might have talked about in the past. I don't remember. I think it was when I was away that this Torah portion came. 24. At a night encampment on the way, the Lord encountered him and sought to kill him. God tries to kill Moses on the way to Egypt. Impossible to understand. It's a whole another can of kosher worms. So Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his legs with it, saying, you are truly a bridegroom of blood to me. And when he let him alone, I mean, when God let Moses alone, she added a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. Completely not clear. A lot to say about it, but not tonight. But what can we figure out from these verses? What's clear is that Zipporah, the wife of Moshe, knows something about Judaism. She knows that circumcision is something those Israelites do. And she understands somehow that she can save her husband from God's wrath by performing circumcision on the son, which she does, and she saves the day. Now, without going into any details, what that clearly means is, to some degree, in some sense, Zipporah has a connection to, an affinity with, an understanding of the ancient customs of the family of Moses that he must have told her about. Now, in these days, the Israelites haven't left Egypt yet. They haven't gotten the Torah yet. The halakha hasn't been developed. There's no such thing as mitzvot. Oh, the only mitzvah is circumcision. That goes back to the book of Genesis. There's no kashrut, there's no Shabbat, there's no holidays. All there is circumcision. And there's certainly nothing that we call conversion. But I would say that What Tzipora does is the closest thing that we can compare to conversion. If she circumcises her son, then I would say she's done whatever you have to do to convert to Judaism. I'm being anachronistic. There's no conversion. There's no such thing as Judaism. There's only the family of Moses and the Israelites. But if she circumcises her son, that shows a deep, deep identification with the tradition that she's heard of the Israelites from her husband Moses, a deep identification with the historical mission of the Israelite people. So she's in this together with Moshe. That's what I would say. She's not standing by the side. She's no longer an idolater. She's a circumciser. And if you're a woman, you can't be circumcised. The closest you can come is to be a circumciser. That's pretty powerful, right? In a symbolic sense, she makes her son. She ushers her son into the covenant, so I would say that brings her into the covenant in a symbolic fashion as much as you can say at this time, before this mitzvot, before this Torah. So she's on our team, I would say. Okay, so after having said that, let's go on. In the book of Exodus, chapter 18. And we're skipping the whole matter of Moses going to the land of Egypt, and the plagues, and the Seder, and the Exodus. They've gone through the Red Sea, and in chapter 18, it looks like the whole encampment has made it to Mount Sinai, because that's what it says at the beginning of 18, verse 1, 2, let's read on. Yitro, priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after she had been sent home, and her two sons, of whom one was named Gershom, that is to say, I've been a stranger in a foreign land, the other was named Eliezer, meaning the God of my father was my help, and he delivered me from the sword of Paro. Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, brought Moses' sons and wife to him in the wilderness where he was encamped at the mountain of God. So, of course, we have a big question. Wait a second, we just read earlier that Moses told his father-in-law after the burning bush, I'm going to Egypt, and that he took his wife and children with him. We know because Zipporah was there in the hotel on the way to Egypt. And now suddenly we read that Moses has taken the Israelites out of Egypt, and his father-in-law comes and brings the wife and two kids. Wait a second. We missed something here. And there's a little hint in the text, after she had been sent home. What happened? So we're going to read now a midrash that explains what happened. The midrash is on the sheets that I brought. It's called the Mechilta to Rabbi Ishmael. The last page of the source sheets. This is Rashi's paraphrase of the Mechilta. Rashi's commentary on the book of Exodus on the words we just read. And Rashi is quoting from the Mechilta, which goes back over 2,000 years. After his having sent her away, that's a different translation. Ours says, after she had been sent home. Says Rashi, when God said to him in Midian, go return to Egypt, and Moses took his wife and his sons, etc., and went to Egypt. Now the Midrash tells the following story. And Aaron went forth towards him and met him at the mount of God. He, Aaron, said, remember, Aaron was in Egypt. Moses was coming from Midian. They met. Said Aaron to him, who are these? So Moses is on his way with the staff of God to Egypt on his mission. Aaron encounters Moses on the way. And Aaron sees he's bringing with him a wife and two kids. Aaron says, who are these? He answered, this is my wife, who I married in Midian, and these are my children. He thereupon asked him, whither are you taking them? He replied, well, to Egypt. Whereupon he said to him, we have cause to grieve over the former ones, and you propose to add to their number? Moses therefore said to her, return to your father's house. She took her two sons and went away. It makes perfect sense. Moses is entering a war zone. They are slaves, the Israelites, and there's about to be a war, 10 plagues, fire and brimstone. Says Aaron, you want to bring your wife and children to slavery? If they're not already slaves, keep them out of it. You want to bring them to a war zone? Keep them out of it. So Moses sends her and the two kids back to Midian, and Moses makes his way to Egypt, does the great things he does, the 10 plagues, etc., etc., etc. They make it out of Egypt, come to the mountain of God after 50 days, about to receive the Torah, and there comes Moses' father-in-law. It's been about a year that he's been separated from his wife and family, Moses has, brings the wife and kids, and Moses says, thank you. That makes perfect sense. There's nothing too complicated in this. So let's go back and continue reading the verses where we were reading them. Let me look at my notes for a second. Okay. Yeah.
We're not necessarily talking about modern-day Ethiopia.
Geographically, we more or less are.
Okay.
More or less. Yeah.
Okay.
It might include what today you call Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
It might even extend beyond the Gulf into what we call Saudi Arabia, but we're talking more or less. I mean, it's a big area. It's bigger than Texas.
Okay.
That's big. But more or less, we are talking about the same area. So for Yitro to pick up with Tzipor and the two kids and go from where they are to Mount Sinai, it could be a 5-day journey, it could be an 8-day journey.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to read on where we were in chapter 18.
In Exodus?
In Exodus 18:6, just where we left off, we'll continue. He sent word to Moses, I, your father-in-law, and did I emphasize that Moses encamped with the people at the mountain of God at Mount Sinai? Right? That's the end of verse 5. And that's where Yitro finds him. He sent word to Moshe, I, your father-in-law, Yitro, am coming to you with your wife and your two sons. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law. He bowed low and kissed him. Each asked about the other's welfare, and they went into the tent. Moses then recounted to his father-in-law everything the Lord had done to Paro and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardships that had befallen them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. And Yitro rejoiced over all the kindness that God had shown Israel when he delivered them from the Egyptians. Blessed be the Lord, Yitro said, who delivered you from the Egyptians and from Paro, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, yes, by the result of their very schemes against the people. And Yitro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to partake of the meal before God with Moses' father-in-law. So that's verses 1 to 12. And now let's read also 13 and 14. Next day, Moses sat as magistrate among the people, while the people stood about Moses from morning until evening. But when Moses' father-in-law saw how much he had to do for the people, he said, what is this thing that you are doing to the people? Why do you act alone while all the people stand about you from the morning to the evening? And then we will skip the rest of the verses in which Moses gets advice from his father-in-law how to lead this people. It's not just you. His father-in-law says, why don't you appoint ministers and helpers and assistants? And that's what Moses does. At the end of the story, we'll just read the last verse of chapter 18. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way to his own land. We have to think about that verse. I'll read it again. Then Moses bade his father-in-law farewell, and he went his way to his own land. That is difficult, because let's now put everything together. After the Exodus, the Israelites with Moses make it to Mount Sinai. Yitro, or whatever his name is, Reuel, or Chovav, Moses' father-in-law, comes and meets him there. They spend some good time together. They bond. Moses tells his father-in-law the story. His father-in-law is very appreciative, says, "Wow, your God is great. I'm on your side." They make some sacrifices. Moses, the next morning, goes to work, and his father-in-law gives him advice how to do the work better. And then his father-in-law goes to his own land, presumably leaving the wife and the kids. But wait a second. Wait a second. This is all at Mount Sinai. Exodus. But we learned that in the book of Numbers, this week's Torah portion, after about a year has passed, about 11 months at Sinai, we read that Moses' father-in-law is still there. I mean, here in verse 27, it says Moses' father-in-law left. But a year later, to be more exact, about 9, 10 months later, 10 and a half, his father-in-law is still there in the book of Numbers. And then Moses says, "We're on our way to the promised land. Please come." His father-in-law says, "No." Moshe says, "Please." And then we don't know what happened. So we're stuck. What happened? Now there's two possibilities. There's only two possibilities. Either there's two separate stories. That here in Exodus, his father-in-law came and left. Then in the book of Numbers, it says his father-in-law is there. He's not still there. He's there again. If it's two separate stories. So his father-in-law came and left. That's Exodus. The book of Numbers says father-in-law is there. It must be that he came again. And then he either left or didn't leave or went with them to the land of Israel. Doesn't say. But if you don't want to add in this information, his father-in-law came again, you'll have to conflate the two stories, which is certainly possible. The Torah always describes the same event from different perspectives. And if we say like that, if we conflate the two stories, it means that here in verse 27, when it says that Moses bade his father-in-law farewell and he went his way to his own land, that's true, but it didn't happen immediately. It happened after a year. And the Torah is just closing off the story that it began. And that would explain why in the book of Numbers, when Moses says, "Please come with us," and father-in-law says, "No," Moses says, "Please," it doesn't say what his father-in-law's reaction was, because we've already been told. He left. Because we were conflating the two stories. So his father-in-law came at the time of the giving of the Ten Commandments at Sinai. They had their good interaction. And he didn't leave until 10 months later, when Moses said, "We're on our way, we're packing up our bags, do you want to come?" He said no. Moses said yes. And then Moses bade his father in farewell and they went his way to his own land. You have to just see that the Torah is telling the same story at different points, because again, we're in the same place, we're still at Mount Sinai. The book of Bamidbar is just a continuation of what we have here.
Well, does the next sentence sort of chapter 19, the first sentence of 19. It's 3 months later, they're doing something else. But he left before the next 3 months, it seems, the way it's written.
So I'm suggesting no. I'm suggesting no. Right. I'm suggesting that the story in chapter 18 began when it began, when it's told, but it didn't end until 10 months later. The verse 27 is there just to give you a foreshadowing of how it's going to end. But it didn't end until much, much later. And this is not uncommon literary technique. Actually give you, just see if I can give you an example of this. There are so many of them. Let's see if it's an easy example. Yeah, I'll give you an example of this, a perfect example. Go to the book of Genesis, chapter 11, verse 32. Chapter 11, verse 32 in the book of Genesis. Okay? Chapter 11 is the story of the generations of the earth after the flood. This one gave birth to this one and died. Gave birth to this one and died. Gave birth to this one and died. And then you get to Abraham's family. Let's look at verse 31. Chapter 11, verse 31. Terach took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of son Avram. They set out together from Ur of the Chaldim for the land of Canaan, but when they had come as far as Haran, they settled there. The days of Terach came to 205 years, and Terach died in Haran. Next verse. The Lord said to Abraham, go forth from your native land and from your father's house, land that I'll show you. I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. Your name will be a blessing, etc. In the order it's written, Terach died, then Abram was told by God to go to the land of Israel, right? That's the order it's written? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you do the chronology, Abram was 75 when he left for the land of Israel. His father still had 65 years left of his life. His father didn't die. If you do the mathematics, his father didn't die before he left for Israel. But the Torah just gives the verse that he died to finish up with the story of his father before it begins the story of Abraham. It's not written in chronological order. It's written in thematic. Thematically it's written. That's just an example of the same phenomena. You find it again and again and again and again and again. That's why the Midrash says that Ein mukdam u'muchar b'Torah. There's no earlier and later in the Torah. Things aren't always in chronological order. They're in thematic order. And again, it's not strange. Many, many books are written in that fashion. You finish up something, then you begin something else. Anyway, the reason we did all this was not simply to teach you the chronology. We're getting to something. Remember what our original question was? Original question was why, after 60 years of marriage, did Aaron and Miriam suddenly get so upset with Moshe that he married this Cushite, this Ethiopian woman? And we're now trying to answer that question, and the truth is, we've now answered it. We just have to show you how we have answered that. Putting everything together. Here we go. So Moses gets married as a young man in the area, in the locale of his wife's family, in Midian, in Ethiopia, in Cush, someplace in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in what's today Ethiopia, someplace around there. He gets married. Now, of course, there's no Jew, no Israelite that knows that he got married. He's far from where all the Israelites are. And he spends about 60 years there. Then he picks up, after hearing from God at the burning bush, with his wife and kids on the way to Egypt. But he's stopped at the border by Aaron, who says, don't bring your family into this country, it's a war zone. And his family is sent back home. Which means that when Moses encounters the elders of the Israelites and the whole nation, they don't know that he's married. They don't see his wife. He's been married again for 60 years, but they don't see his wife. Okay. And then he takes the Israelites from slavery to freedom, 10 plagues, they get to Mount Sinai, and then his wife shows up with his father-in-law and the two kids. And then for about 10 months, his father-in-law is there. Which means that from the point of view of all the Israelites, they don't see Moshe interacting with his wife. They see Moshe interacting with his father-in-law and his father-in-law's daughter. You don't see Moses strolling in the streets with his wife. You see Moses strolling in the streets with his father-in-law. That's all the interaction between men, right, that we just read about. His father-in-law sits in the tent with them, Moses tells the story of the great things God did. His father-in-law says, wow, that's pretty good. I'm a believer now. They offer sacrifices. Then Moses goes to judge the people, as we read, and his father-in-law sits there and gives them advice. The interaction is between men. Zipporah, I suppose, is in the tent. In those days, that's where women often were. The first time that the Israelites come face to face with the fact that Moses has a wife is when the father-in-law goes back home and leaves Zipporah and the two children. That's when the bystanders, the Israelite people, including Aaron and Miriam, that's when they come face to face with the fact that Zipporah is staying here, even when her father is is gone. So now, going back to our Torah portion, things begin to make a little bit of sense. Let's go back to where we started, to chapter 12 of the book of Numbers. Chapters 11 and 12 in the book of Numbers. Okay. So we read, it's the end of chapter 10. We read the end of chapter 10 that Moses tells his father-in-law, we're out of here. We've been at Sinai about 10 months. We're packing up and moving. And his father-in-law says, I'm not coming. Moses says, please. Father-in-law doesn't react, but we already read that in Exodus, it says that he left. So he left. So the minute he leaves, that's 10, chapter 10. A minute later, you get to chapter 12. They go to Hatzirot. They're on their journey. And Zipporah suddenly is in Moses' tent. It's not anymore Reuel, Yitro, who's there. It's Zipporah. And that's when it says, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moshe because of the Cushite woman he had married. He married a Cushite woman. My point is, for the first 60 years of Moses' married life, no Israelite knew about it. When they left Egypt, she wasn't there. When they got to Mount Sinai, she wasn't there. Then she came with her father-in-law, but for 10 months, it was the father-in-law, and she was just an adjunct. When the father-in-law leaves, that's when the whole Israelite people see that their venerable leader, who they look up to like a god, who they always thought he was a singular, solitary leader, he has a wife, and she's not Jewish. She's not Jewish. And now just think of the commotion that breaks loose. Because remember, we had said that the Israelites had sunk to the bottom of the spiritual barrel in Egypt. They were idolaters, just like the Egyptians. They were assimilated. It's very possible that they were intermarried. In order to leave Egypt, remember we had said that they had to offer the sacrificial lamb, the Passover lamb, which remember we had said was a symbolic way of extricating themselves from Egyptian idolatry, that the Egyptians worshipped the lamb. And by God telling them to kill the lamb on their front lawn, to make a big barbecue, to sacrifice it and then cook it with all the smoke and with all the smell, and then smear on the front door the blood, it's to show all the Egyptians that we have extricated ourselves from idolatry. It's civil disobedience, like burning the American flag on your front lawn. We don't have anything to do with this culture anymore. And it's because God gave them the opportunity to express their loyalty to God and their repudiation of idolatry. That's why they were taken out of slavery by God, because of the merit of their ability to turn over a new leaf. And now they see that their leader is married to a non-Jewish woman. How could that be? And that's why Miriam and Aaron, right at this moment, when Yitro leaves and leaves the girl there, she's 80 years old, leaves the girl there with Moses. Moses, how can you show your face to the people? How are we going to get them to keep mitzvot? How are we going to get them to take upon themselves this developing Jewish identity? You're married... It's a scandal. It's a scandal.
But she's circumcised her.
So there we get exactly to the issue, right? She is not Jewish, and can I say in mixed company that she's not of the same skin color of the Israelites? Right? She's a Cushite woman, and they're all from Eastern Europe. She's not Jewish. Oh, but she converted. Well, there wasn't really such a thing as conversion. It was just so, from the point of view of Moses, she's on our team. She's one of us. But how do you tell that to the press? What is he saying when the reporters ask those hard questions? Show me her conversion certificate. She doesn't look like one of us. It gets very difficult. And now I want to try and flesh this out by looking at a number of different midrashim and thoughts. So let's see. The first place we could look is Right. Let's tell a story. Let's go to one of the stories I brought on the last page here. This is a story that's going to shed light on what we're talking about, but it's based on verses later on in the Torah. It's based on chapter 25, verse 5. So let's look at 25, verse 5 in the book of Numbers. 25, verse 5. This is after 39 years in the desert. The Israelites have already made it to the borders of the land of Israel after going through the desert. And it says the following: when Israel was staying in Shittim, that is right across from the city of Jordan, on the other side of Jericho, other side of the Jordan River. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people profaned themselves by whoring with Moabite women, who invited
Where are we?
25, verse 1, in the book of Numbers.
Okay. You said 5.
I said 5. Sorry. Okay. I stand corrected.
Okay, we were in the right spot. The one.
Is there a page?
Yeah.
25, 1. Okay. While Israel was staying at Shittim, the people profaned themselves by whoring with the Moabite women, who invited the people to the sacrifices for their God. So it was licentiousness, or it was prostitution together with idolatry. The people partook of them and worshipped that God. Thus Israel attached itself to Baal Peor, that's the name of that God, and the Lord was incensed with Israel. The Lord said to Moses, take all the ringleaders and have them publicly impaled before the Lord, so that the Lord's wrath may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the Israelite officials, each of you slay those of his men who attached themselves to Baal Peor. Just then, one of the Israelites came and brought a Midianite woman, what woman? A Midianite woman, over to his companions. In the sight of Moses and of the whole Israelite community who were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And what it says, brought a Midianite woman over to his companions, means he engaged in sexual licentiousness in front of everyone, showing them that the real thing to do is not to worship God, it's to worship this Moabite God, this Midianite God, through prostitution. And we have such ideas in ancient world of worship through sexual licentiousness. When Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, saw this, he left the assembly, and taking a spear in his hand, he followed the Israelite into the chamber and stabbed both of them, when they're in the act of sexual intercourse, the Israelite and the woman, through the belly. Then the plague against the Israelite was checked. Okay. There's a midrash in the Talmud that asks the question, why didn't Moses do something? Moses is there, and the sight of Moses, this Israelite comes with this Midianite prostitute, and they prostitute themselves in the central courtyard. Why didn't Moses do anything? Look what the Midrash says. You ready? Hold on to your chairs. Mm-hmm. We're reading the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sanhedrin, page 82a. And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that were joined unto Baal Peor. That's a verse that we just read. It's a quote. Thereupon the tribe of Shimon went to Zimri ben Salu, that's their prince, that's their leader, and said to him, behold, capital punishment is being meted out, yet you sit silent? In other words, we're all involved in what we really believe in, which is sexual licentiousness and prostitution. That's the way we worship this god of Baal Peor. And we want you to defend us because Moses is telling everyone to kill us for what we're doing. That's what they say to their leader, to Zimri ben Salu. What did he do? He arose and assembled 24,000 Israelites and went to Cozbi. Cozbi is supposed to be, well, she is, a woman from the Midianites. And said to her, surrender thyself unto me. She replied, I'm a king's daughter, and thus hath my father instructed me, thou shalt yield only to their greatest man. I too replied, I'm the prince of a tribe. Moreover, my tribe is greater than Moses's, for mine is second in birth, while his is third. He then seized her by the hair, and brought her before Moshe. Son of Amram, he exclaimed, that's Moses' nickname, is this woman forbidden or permitted? And should you say she is forbidden, who permitted thee, Jethro's daughter? In other words, here's this great rebellion against the Jewish people after 39 years in the desert, rebellion of idolatry and sexual promiscuity with Moabite and Midianite women, and one of the transgressors, according to the Talmudic Midrash, comes to the public square, and as he's about to have intercourse with this girl in front of everyone, he says to Moses, "You can't stop me, because who are you married to?" And if we take this story at face value, it's trying to tell us that Moses had a public relations debacle with his wife Zipporah. And even after all the years in the desert, he didn't manage to deal with it. Which only brings us back to the question, well, perhaps not just a public relations issue, perhaps he really shouldn't be married to her. Ah, but she took upon herself Judaism. Ah, but there wasn't such a thing as conversion. How do you deal with all this? It's pretty complicated. But that's not the end of the story. I want to show you now a super commentator on Rashi. Right? Rashi, remember, is a commentator on the Torah, and there are commentators on Rashi. There's over 100 commentators on the commentary of Rashi. This one is called Tiferet Yonatan. And I photocopied it. I translated and photocopied it at the end of our source sheet. It's here. It's the end of the sheet that has my typing on it. And here he's commenting on the Rashi that we read earlier. The Rashi that has Moses on his way to Midian with his wife and two kids. Aaron meets them and says, "You can't bring them to Egypt, send them back home. We have enough problems with the former ones, with the Israelites already enslaved. Want to bring more Jews into Egypt?" Look what Tiferet Yonatan says about that. Here we are. "We have cause to grieve over the former ones, and you're bringing more?" Remember that line from Rashi? "This is difficult," says the Tiferet Yonatan. "I don't understand what Rashi is saying. For the tribe of Levi was not enslaved. We have a tradition that Paro didn't enslave the Levites. So if Moses is a Levite, what's wrong with bringing his family to Egypt? They won't be enslaved because they're on a pedestal. Paro doesn't enslave them." That's the Midrashic background. "And in any case, or furthermore, in any case, the time of redemption has arrived. So what's wrong? Why does everyone say don't bring them? Redemption is on us. We're going to be out of here another few months. So not so bad to bring your wife and kids. Why does Aaron object nevertheless to the bringing of Zipporah and the children into the land of Egypt? Rather, the claim of Zimri is well known." That's what we just read in the Talmud. Zimri ben Salu. "The daughter of Yitro, who permitted her to you?" Just read that. "And he did not accept that she was a convert for the sake of heaven." In other words, no one accepted when Moses said that my wife, she's okay. She's an exception. She's been converted for the sake of heaven. "Now in Egypt, the Israelites transgressed the covenant of circumcision, but they did not intermarry with the women of the land." That's the claim of this commentator. "And Aaron was afraid that if Zipporah would enter the land and the Israelites would see that Moses took a Midianite woman, God forbid, they would themselves marry Egyptian women, for they would not be able to make a distinction, and divine wrath would come upon them, God forbid." And that is what the Midrash means when it says, that Rashi quoted, "We have cause to grieve over the former ones, that they transgressed the covenant of circumcision, the Israelites in Egypt, and now in addition we have to worry that they will want to marry the women of the land, God forbid. And therefore he sent her back to Midian." So, according to this commentary, the things that I said, that I attributed to Aaron and Miriam in the book of Numbers, this commentary is attributing them to Aaron already back in the book of Exodus, that Moses, you just can't join the Jewish people with that wife. It's just not going to work. You have to be a role model. So Moses sent her back, according to what we read. But then when she comes with her father-in-law in the book of Numbers, and then the father-in-law goes back and leaves her there, so Moses, what is he going to do? And the case I'm trying to make, as we said, is that that's the foundation of the objection of Aaron and Miriam. It's not like other Midrashim that Moses divorced his wife and that's what so upsets them. Rather, this is the first time they're actually seeing husband and wife together, and they're telling Moses that cannot be. And the truth is, they want Moses to divorce her. They want Moses to send her back. Just think of all the modern issues that this brings up. You know, our political leaders are in the limelight, and we look at their spouses, and we examine their personal life. And there certainly could be cases in which it's okay, but it just doesn't play right in public. It doesn't play right in the press. People can't accept it. And perhaps it does sometimes show a bad example, even though it might be okay in its essence, or it might not. But the leader has to be worried not just about what's right, but how things look.
When Moses set out for Egypt after the burning bush, where was Aaron?
In Egypt. In Egypt. But Aaron met him on the border when Moses was about to make it back to Egypt and said, take your wife back to Midian. Keep her there. Now,
was Aaron older?
According to the Torah, he was 2 years older.
Okay, so that's why he wasn't killed.
That's what you have, right. He was apparently born before the decree to throw the firstborn into the sea. Now, there's just one more. What time is it? Is it time to finish?
Close.
Okay, yeah, it's time to finish. Now, I just want to add some more background and richness to this issue. That remember, let's look at the verses, that when the Israelites left Egypt, they left together with what the Torah calls a mixed multitude, an Erev Rav. And it makes sense. You know, the Israelites are getting out of slavery, so many other slaves want to take a free ride and get out also. That's in Exodus, I think it's chapter 12 or 13. Let's look. We're looking at chapter 12 of the book of Exodus, and the exact verse is going to be 37 and 38. 37 and 38 of chapter 12. The Israelites journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, right after leaving, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. Moreover, a mixed multitude went up with them, and very much livestock, etc. So what happened to this mixed multitude, and what was the interaction between the mixed multitude, some of whom could have been Midianites, of course, what was the interaction between the mixed multitude and the Israelite camp? Now, the Israelites are divided into tribes. They walk, they march by their tribes. Where's the mixed multitude? So it just so happens in this week's Torah portion, there's a discussion of the mixed multitude. We'll go to this week's Torah portion. Chapter 11. That's the chapter we didn't look at. That's the chapter that we skipped. Chapter 11 in the book of Numbers. So just as it began to march from Mount Sinai towards the land of Israel, in chapter 11, the people took to complaining bitterly before the Lord. The Lord heard and was incensed. A fire of the Lord broke out against them, ravaging the outskirts of the camp. Now in Rashi's commentary, he asks, who was encamped on the outskirts of the camp? Of course, the mixed multitude, those who don't have a place to encamp with their tribes. The people cried out to Moses. Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. That place was named Tavera, which means fire, because a fire of the Lord had broken out against them. The riffraff in their midst felt the gluttonous craving, and then the Israelites wept and said, etc. Who's the riffraff? That's the mixed multitude, says Rashi. So the point is that it could very well be that the mixed multitude, the non-Israelites, they went out of Egypt, but they don't have the same commitment to God, they don't have the commitment to the mission. And everything, something goes wrong. There's no food, a little bit of trial and tribulation. They complain. And the ultimate cause, the Israelites, to be infected by the bug of complaining. So here you have in chapter 11, the mixed multitude complaining, causing problems. And then chapter 12, when Aaron and Miriam speak against Zipporah. You see those illegal immigrants? you see the issues they're causing, and then it turns out that Moses is married to an illegal immigrant. I can imagine this in the papers, right? It turns out that the governor of a certain state, his wife, doesn't have proper citizenship papers. What? Okay, she's lived here her whole life. She's a good citizen, didn't break any law, but she's not one of us. So anyway, the truth is, this really could be just the beginning of a whole discussion. Now, the Torah, 36 times warns that one has to behave compassionately compassionately and properly towards a sojourner, towards the other. And the halakha interprets that to be the convert. But why does the Torah have to warn 36 times to behave properly towards the other, towards a convert? Because the human tendency, the natural human tendency, is to not do so. Always to look at those who are different than us, whether it's skin color, whether it's origin, and to find a reason to criticize, find a reason to push them aside, to go back where you belong, go back where you came from. And it turns out it just might be that that's exactly what's happening in these verses in our Torah portion. And with all that background, we can end by reminding ourselves of God's reaction to the complaint of Aaron and Miriam. God says, you have no right complaining. And he ends up, as we read, punishing Aaron and Miriam, primarily Miriam, very seriously. And according to everything we've said, what's really going on, perhaps, is this irrational fear of foreigners and this racism to not have them in our midst. And God says, if that's the way you behave towards Moses' Midianite wife, then Miriam, you'll be punished for that. And notice what her punishment was. It was 7 days, you're outside of the camp. Why don't we read that, and that will be our closing, chapter 12, verse 14, 15, and 16. Let's begin with verse 13. Chapter 12, verse 13. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, O God, pray heal her. She was afflicted with these white scales. But the Lord said to Moses, if her father spat in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp for 7 days, and then let her be readmitted. So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not march on until Miriam was readmitted. That's the story. So, with that, we end a whole year of study together. And everyone's invited back next year.
Six.
Oh,
thank
amazing.
You.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
I asked him when he started. I can't remember.
What was an Aaron part of it?
We did.
Doesn't say. No. So this is really relevant to you. You know, people look at your wife. Do they say things about her husband?
But I'm not sure why that's relevant.
Because your wife is the leader of the people.
Well, I'm not a midian.
You must have some skeletons in the closet. The press has not dug and found out who they are.
Many years ago, I was in public office in Plano, and they just said to me, you're lucky.
That's so nice.